Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. An unsuspecting handyman who harbored many dark secrets, including drug use, necrophilia, rape, and murder. A gap in his killings have led to many questions which remain unanswered. In this episode, you'll come to know the man known as the Killer Handyman, William Patrick Fife. Okay, on to the show. William's early life is shrouded in mystery. He was born to a single mother on February 27, 1955, in Toronto, Ontario. Without a husband to help support the child they conceived together, William's mother struggled emotionally and financially, often leaving William neglected. When her family realized what she was going through, they convinced her to send William at the age of 3 to live with an aunt in Montreal. William was withheld from the outside world for most of his childhood. His aunt was a well-known recluse. William's mother wouldn't be in his life again until they reconnected when he was in his 30s. Although a book would later be written about his life and crimes, William shied away from discussing his childhood. Despite this, author C.L. Swinney didn't believe he was abused by his mother or aunt because of his victim demographics. This will be important to note much later in the episode. He successfully graduated from high school and decided to pursue a career as a carpenter and handyman, a trade he excelled in. William's life of crime began in 1977 at the age of 22. During this time, William was convicted of several crimes including abduction, libel, theft, breaking and entering, and pretending to solemnize a marriage. At the center of his life of crime was a drug habit. When he couldn't find work as a painter, carpenter, and pool builder, he would turn to burglary to pay for his drug habit. As a handyman, William developed a reputation as someone who would charge fair prices and did competent work. It was this ability to be two people at once that made it so William would get away with his crimes for as long as he did. William moved to Quebec from Toronto because of his drug problem. He recognized the problem he had and checked himself into a drug rehabilitation program. He kicked his habit, but it's unknown if he stayed clean while he was carrying out his crimes. William enjoyed the program so much that he would eventually become a counselor for that program. Despite getting clean, William's crimes caught up with him and he went to jail from 1977 to 1979. William would stay out of trouble from when he left jail in 1979 until he was caught in 1999. A question that still haunts investigators to this day is how many victims did William have during this 20-year span? Like his childhood, there are many questions surrounding his adult life. Commander Andre Bouchard, the primary investigator in William's crimes, stated that he believed that William was married for up to 4 years and even fathered a child, but there are no marriage licenses or birth certificates to back this up. It's just another thing that makes William such a mystery. Regardless, as an adult, Williams lived under the radar and was able to blend in well with society. Not much is known about his earlier murders. William Fife killed his first victim that we know of on October 17, 1979. Technically, William was in jail during this time, but he received a day pass. That was when he carried out this horrendous crime. Suzanne Marie Bernier, a 62-year-old woman, was found stabbed to death in Cartierville, Montreal. Her face, body, and neck were badly bruised from a beating. Evidence also suggested that Suzanne Marie had been sexually assaulted after her death. The scene was very gory, but police could find no physical evidence nor any witnesses. The case went cold, but stayed open pending discovery of new evidence. Less than a month later, William had another victim. 26-year-old Nicole Raymond was discovered stabbed to death in Pointe-Claire, Montreal. Like Suzanne Marie, Nicole's remains showed signs of sexual assault after death. Nicole's crime scene was extremely bloody and indicated that she had put up a fight. Investigators noted the similarities between Nicole's and Suzanne Marie's crime scenes, but did not yet think they were dealing with a serial killer. Unfortunately, the crime scene turned up no leads, and there were no witnesses. The case went cold, but stayed open, much like Suzanne Marie's, pending discovery of new evidence. On March 21, 1981, the body of 52-year-old Hazel Scatalon was found in her home in Montreal. She had been stabbed and beaten to death. Like the women before her, she had been sexually assaulted after death. By this point, investigators saw the similarities between Hazel's murder and the murders of Suzanne Marie and Nicole, including the fact that she lived alone. The idea of a serial killer was starting to worm its way into the minds of the police, though they held back from announcing anything publicly. There was a short lull in the murders, but they picked back up in 1987, this time in Quebec. 37-year-old Louise Poupart LeBlanc was found stabbed and beaten to death on September 26, 1987, in Saint-Adèle-Laurentide. She had been sexually assaulted after death. DNA was found at the scene and came back as male. The case would eventually go cold like much of the other cases before it, but DNA at the scene would prove to be very important 12 days later. Another body would be found in Saint-Adèle-Laurentide. On June 9, 1989, 45-year-old Pauline LaPlante would be found stabbed and beaten to death. Like all the others, she was sexually assaulted after death. Police found a very important clue while investigating Pauline's murder. They noticed that her home showed no sign of forced entry, leading police to speculate that the killer could be posing as a handyman or a plumber in order to gain access to his victims' homes. Law enforcement took this information public and warned women in the Greater Montreal area not to open their homes to anyone they don't know. While a few leads were developed during the investigation of Pauline's murder, they dried up quickly and the case went cold. Then, for 10 years, there was nothing. But that peace was shattered on October 15, 1999, in Sinville, Quebec. Sinville is a small, close community on Montreal's West Island, which made this murder all the more shocking. The body of 59-year-old Anna Yarnold was found by her husband, who did not live with her, in the backyard of her home. Anna had been beaten in the head with a cement flower pot. After murdering her, her killer went back into the house and rifled through her purse. He took a few things, including her bank card. Robert told police that he went to check on Anna because she was not answering his phone calls. The day before, Anna took her beloved dog Trooper to the vet to inquire about getting some tumors removed. When the cost proved to be too high, Anna went home dejected and worried about her dog. Robert was calling Anna to check up on her and Trooper. When she didn't answer, he drove to her home. He saw her car in the driveway, so he let himself inside. Trooper, who normally greeted Robert at the door, was nowhere to be found. Robert searched the home and eventually found the terrified dog hiding in the upstairs bedroom. Robert continued to search the house for Anna until he found her in the backyard in a pool of her own blood with the cement flower pot next to her head. Police did not initially connect Anna's death with William's other victims. It's completely understandable. After all, it had been 10 years since the murder of Pauline LaPlante. Police instead focused their investigation on Anna's husband, Robert Yarnold. Police worked hard to connect him to the crime in order to close the case quickly. At one point, they brought in Robert and Anna's daughter, Sarah, for questioning. They didn't tell her about her mother's murder, instead asking her about her parents' relationship. Finally, one of the investigators blurted out, "Well, your mother is dead." The way the police handled the notification would traumatize Sarah for years. The investigation would shift, however, after the discovery of the body of 46-year-old Monique Gaudreau on October 29, 1999, in her home in Sainte-Agathe-de-Mons, Quebec. Sainte-Agathe-de-Mons is a picturesque tourist town located 100 kilometers or 62 miles north of Montreal. Like Cineville, the residents of Sainte-Agathe-de-Mons knew each other well. On the morning of October 29th, Monique's co-workers at a local hospital began to worry. Monique hadn't shown up for work, and the nurse was normally very punctual. They tried reaching Monique on her phone, but no one answered. Next, they called Monique's sister to see if she knew where Monique was. Monique's sister knew Monique had work the next day, so she drove to Monique's apartment and let herself in, using an extra key she had. The apartment was clear until she reached the bedroom. There, she found Monique's bloody body sprawled at the foot of her bed. Her head and torso were mutilated, and her clothes were pulled off around her waist. Monique had been stabbed approximately 55 times. Her body also showed signs of sexual assault after death. Monique's sister immediately called police, who arrived quickly. Pools of blood found throughout the scene indicated that Monique fought hard for her life. Police were concerned because of the shocking murder scene. This was not a normal murder, but someone who had a lot of rage. He would be very dangerous until he was caught. The police file noted there were no signs of forced entry, no fingerprints, and no murder weapon. However, a bloody shoe print was found in the landing area near the front door. They also found blood droplets leading from the front door to the side of the house, indicating the route the killer took when he left the scene. Despite working hard to find forensic evidence, a suspect would not be developed until there was another murder. I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor. Monique's murder was not initially linked to Anna's because Anna was not stabbed or sexually assaulted. On November 19, 1999, the body of 55-year-old Teresa Shanahan was found in Laval, Quebec. Laval is Montreal's largest suburb and is separated from the mainland by a river. The city is well known for technology, centering on pharmaceutical, industrial, and retail sectors. Around 10 a.m. that morning, Teresa's co-workers were beginning to wonder where their accountant was. They had called her home multiple times, but no one answered. They finally called police for a welfare check. When police arrived, there were a few newspapers stacked at the front of the door. Police got the building concierge to open the door to her apartment. When they walked in, they found Teresa's body in a pool of blood. Teresa had been beaten as well as stabbed about 32 times. Because of the similarities between this scene and Monique's, police were beginning to think that both women were killed by the same man. Some in the department began to speculate that they could have a serial killer on their hands. But like the police 20 years before, they kept their suspicions from the public. Teresa's killer also stole her jewelry and bank cards. When they looked into her bank activity, police saw that Teresa's card was used the night before to withdraw $500 right before midnight and $500 right after midnight. Cameras caught the killer using her bank cards, but he was wearing a hooded sweatshirt. Police also noted that he used Teresa's PIN number. If this was merely a robbery attempt and she gave him her PIN, then why would he kill her? Around the same time, Sarah, Anna Yarnold's daughter, noticed that her mother's bank cards had been used after her death. She told police, who then went to the ATM cameras to get images of the killer. Like the man who used Teresa Shanahan's card, he was wearing a hooded sweatshirt while at the ATM. Police released the photo to an anxious public who wanted to solve the murders. They were angry and disappointed by the fact that the photos were not helpful at all in identifying the killer. However, this did lead police to no longer consider Robert Yarnold a suspect in his wife's murder. After Teresa's murder, the citizens of Montreal and its surrounding cities began to grow concerned about the exceptionally brutal slayings. That concern would turn into full-fledged panic when the body of 50-year-old Mary Glenn was found on December 15, 1999, in Baie des Herbes, Quebec, an affluent community west of Montreal. She was found by a houseworker who let herself in the house after no one answered the door. She called police, who arrived at the scene quickly. Mary's death was extremely violent. She was beaten, stabbed, and sexually assaulted after death. Evidence showed that the attack began in Mary's kitchen, then moved into her office, then towards the stairs, and finally ended back in the kitchen. After killing Mary, her murderer washed his hands in her sink. He then went upstairs into Mary's bedroom and took items from her purse. He was able to slip away without being noticed by anyone. Police found no sign of forced entry, so Mary let her killer inside of her home. Police wondered what kind of ruse he would have used, especially considering the news was covering a possible serial killer in the area. They did, however, find faint bloody footprints inside the home. They were different from the ones found at Monique's crime scene. Not much evidence was collected in the first hours of the investigation, but investigators knew there had to be something there. Their doggedness would later prove fruitful. Police now had 4 horrific murders in 3 short months. The public was in an uproar because the police played everything so close to the vest. One of the things they kept under wraps was that they found a smudged, partial fingerprint on the door jamb just inside the front door of Mary's home. The print was found during the second day of the investigation, proving investigators' hunch that the scene had to hold more clues. They ran it and kept their fingers crossed. Luck was on their side, and the fingerprint gave them a hint. 44-year-old William Fife. At this point, William was only a person of interest, so he wasn't arrested immediately. They had to let the public know there was a person of interest, but gave themselves a few hours to find William before letting the public know. Police got a break when they received a tip from William's ex-girlfriend. William had reconnected with his biological mother and was staying at her secluded home in Barrie, Ontario. She also told police that William was driving a blue Ford Ranger. Police went to find William's mother's home. They found it at the end of a long gravel road. Parked in front of the home was a blue Ford Ranger whose tags came back as belonging to William Fife, though the address was a different one in Montreal. Regardless, police were excited to learn that William was likely in the area. They ordered 24-hour surveillance on the home in order to locate their person of interest. They wanted to gather more probable cause in order to arrest him. Police observed William leaving his mother's house and followed him. Montreal police joined Ontario police in the surveillance. They had finally laid eyes on the man who could be their possible serial killer. The next day, newspapers across the country displayed William's face and claimed that he had a link to Mary Glenn's murder. Police followed William as he left his mother's house, drove to Toronto, and began looking at several newspapers that claimed he was a murder suspect on their front page. William then drove back to his mother's home and laid low for about 24 hours. On December 21, 1999, police caught William leaving his mother's house with a large black trash bag in tow. He drove into Barrie and dropped the bag next to a bin used to collect items for the needy. Once he left, police swooped in and grabbed the bag. Inside, they discovered 3 pairs of running shoes, each with blood droplets on them. With this find, Ontario Provincial Police and Montreal Police believe they found enough evidence to convict William on at least one murder. On December 22, 1999, authorities followed William to the local gas station and watched as he went inside the convenience store. When William exited the store, he walked back to his truck as if he had nothing to hide. When he opened the driver's door, police ambushed him and arrested him. He didn't resist and blurted out, "Why don't you shoot me now?" After this initial statement, William went silent for quite some time. William was transported to the Ontario Provincial Police Station, where he would be interviewed about the murder of Mary Glenn. The interview room had both a camera and a voice recorder. After his long silence, William asked for a cigarette, which he was given. Once he took his first drag from a cigarette, William's demeanor changed. He became angry, yanking the power cords from the camera at least 3 or 4 times during the interrogation. William then became cold and asked for his lawyer. Investigators left the room, but not before collecting the ashtray containing William's used cigarette. They now had his DNA and could use it to link him to his crimes. The cigarette butts would ultimately seal William's fate. While he sat in a holding cell, investigators obtained a search warrant. Police searched his mother's home as well as his blue Ford Ranger. The running shoes they had collected were sent to a lab for testing. Police found more damning evidence in William's trunk, as well as in his room at his mother's house. The lab determined that the blood on the shoes was human. There was also clothing found at his mother's home that had human blood on them. Based on this evidence, William was booked and charged with the first-degree murder of Mary Glenn. The news spread throughout the Montreal area quickly, and the public was relieved that someone was finally in jail. On a pair of his blue jeans taken from his bedroom, the lab found Anna Yarnold's blood. This placed him at the scene of Anna's murder. The lab also compared him to the pictures captured of the man using Anna's bank card and determined it to be a match to William. Another pair of running shoes matched the bloody footprints found at Monique's crime scene. This evidence also linked him to Monique's murder. Also, the DNA gathered from William's cigarettes was compared to blood droplets found in Monique's home, and it was determined that the blood belonged to William. While searching his bedroom, police found a ring that belonged to Teresa that had been stolen after her murder, along with the initial fingerprint that put William on the police's radar. Forensics linked a pair of William's running shoes to the print found at the murder scene, as well as linking his DNA to a blood droplet found in Mary's home. William was now linked to 4 murders. He was given additional charges for the murders of Anna Yarnold, Monique Goudreau, and Teresa Shanahan. It was at this point that Montreal residents began to feel safe again. A tip came in from Mount Royal. A young man called and told police he used to play hockey with William, and William was hired to paint his mother's house. The man said his mother, Hazel Scatalin, had been murdered in 1979. Her killer had never been caught, and now the man wondered if William had something to do with it. Investigators looked into the lead. DNA from the scene had been preserved and was eventually matched to William. He would now be charged with a 5th murder. William was arraigned in January 2000 for the murders of Mary Glenn, Monique Goudreau, and Anna Yarnold. Though the evidence was stacked against him, he initially pled not guilty. On June 19, 2000, William was arraigned again and charged with the murders of Teresa Shanahan and Hazel Scatalin. William's preliminary hearing began on November 6, 2000. The evidence was overwhelming, and the defense would have had a hard time poking holes in such a well-investigated case. During his court proceedings, more evidence was collected against William, continuing to stack the deck against him. On September 21, 2000, William Fife, apparently seeing the writing on the wall, changed his plea to guilty. On October 16, 2001, William Fife was sentenced to 25 years in prison with no possibility of parole. On November 23, 2001, William agreed to sit down with investigators for an interview. William shocked investigators as he described his first murder, Suzanne Marie Bernier, in 1979. William described how he would knock on the door of affluent homes in Montreal. His victims would invite him in without ever questioning his intent. William went into bloody detail of the murder of Nicole Raymond, and it wasn't long before he admitted to 3 more murders, Nicole Raymond, Louise Poupart LeBlanc, and Pauline LaPlante. In exchange for his confession, William asked to be moved from a Quebec prison to Western Canada. The public did not like the deal, but it went through anyway as investigators wanted to bring closure to the victims' families. William would never be formally charged for these murders. Mark LaBelle, William's lawyer, claimed the reason for the transfer was so William could receive specialized treatment that he could not get in Quebec. The facilities in Saskatoon offered psychiatric care for people like William. Also, William wanted to get away from his notoriety in Quebec. This is certainly different from a lot of other serial killers who crave public attention after they've been caught. William had been described as stubborn and manipulative in his interviews. He would be open about the horrible things he had done, but would never answer why he killed so brutally. There are also many large gaps in William's life that have yet to be filled, frustrating for those who are convinced he has committed more murders than what he has admitted to. As of this recording, William remains in a Saskatchewan psychiatric hospital where he remains elusive to the public eye. Very few facts are known about him personally, and rumors are swirling that he was married and fathered a child in his earlier days. However, there has been no public information released on the matter. Much like William, all of this remains a mystery. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and positively review the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to the show. It really does help get the word out about us and makes us more visible to potential listeners. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Instagram TCFC_podcast, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast, and of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. This episode was written and researched by Brittany Martinez. If you have an episode request, send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. Music for the show was composed by Nico at wetalkofdreams.com. Follow him on Twitter at wetalkofdreams. While you're waiting for the next episode, check out some of my pod friend shows.
It was a dark and stormy night.
Wait, why does it have to be dark and stormy?
Yeah, why can't it be daytime and clear skies?
Oh, for f**k's sakes.
Join us bi-weekly on Coast to Ghost as we take a trip cross-country digging up the ghost of your state.
Drinks are included and pants are optional.
You can listen to Coast to Ghost on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to get spooked?